If you need help getting Social Security disability benefits, then this podcast is for you. Give me 15 minutes and I'll pull back the curtain on disability and reveal the secrets to winning I've learned over the past 25 plus years. Hi, I'm Jonathan Ginsberg, and I'm a practicing Social Security disability lawyer. I want to help deserving claimants just like you win the benefits you deserve and not one penny less. Now, if you already know you need help today, go to ssdanswers.com for a free and confidential evaluation of your case. It takes just 2 minutes. That's ssdanswers.com, and I'd love to hear from you. Now, let's start the show. This is part two of my interview with former Social Security Disability Case Manager and Fraud Examiner Greg Brinkley. In my experience, there are a lot more people with legitimate claims who are denied as opposed to people with fraudulent claims who are approved. However, this seems to be a widely held belief in the United States Congress that the Social Security disability system is riddled with fraud. This perception in Congress matters because it underlies members of Congress' refusal to allocate more money to Social Security or to make this disability system more available to those who really need it. In fact, the only part of SSA's budget that regularly gets more money is the Fraud Investigation Unit. And Greg points out in our interview that during his time at SSA, the number of fraud examiners and investigators doubled. Still, it's important to know what type of conduct might draw the attention of a Social Security fraud examiner. You do not want to come even remotely close to this line, and Greg confirms what I've told my clients for years. Social Security disability relies heavily on objective evidence to approve disability claims. Now, without further ado, let's talk to Greg Brinkley. Hi, welcome back, everybody. We are now in part two of our conversation with Greg Brinkley. Greg is a former Social Security employee. He gave us his background in the last episode. I'd refer you back to that. But we're going to talk now about fraud. And I will tell you, Greg, that I get a lot of comments on the YouTube channel and just in conversation in general that there is this perception out there that Social Security is riddled with fraud, that most of the people or a good percentage of the people applying or receiving disability really can work, that they're not disabled. What is your take on that?
I think that it is a talking point that is not based in truth. The percentages of people who are applying for Social Security disability will show that the vast majority are applying for the right reasons. They cannot work anymore. They would like to work, but are not able to. They are struggling and have fallen on hard times to where they don't have any income or very little income. And because of that, their last resort in so many cases is to apply for disability. I don't believe that a lot of people want to apply for disability. I think that it's really more just a necessary result of dealing with life and an illness or injury. So they really don't have nowhere else to turn. I would say that in large part, those who are committing fraud would be those who are specifically intending to get over on the system in whatever way possible, depending upon the circumstances and considering who it is that is involved, such as doctors, lawyers, ethnic groups. There are advocates involved. There ALJs, administrative law judges, and the general public who believe that they have the best scheme possible. And what they typically find out is if Social Security doesn't get them on the front end, they will get them on the back end.
So give me an idea of what type of case would attract the attention of a fraud investigator. What are the sort of the indicia of fraud that you might have investigated before?
What I've seen And people who are applying for disability, just the average person who wants to apply, those individuals who are intending to commit fraud usually would over-exaggerate their symptoms, and the records would not bear that out. And there is a huge discrepancy between what they reported and what the records show. Also, there are individuals who, for instance, show up at a consultative exam and proceed to go through an act or a ruse where they are so disabled to where they can't open the door and they can barely be touched. The doctor wants to palpate or touch them, and they're flinching and they're guarding. So those types of things, that's what will attract Social Security's attention when over-exaggeration of symptoms becomes so pronounced, even on certain forms, where if they're filing the functional report or the activities of daily living form, they would say, "I can't do anything at all." Well, that's a red flag, because if you can't do anything at all, that communicates to the examiner, well, either this person is literally bedridden, they cannot get out of the bed or the chair without some form of assistance, or they're malingering and they're faking and they're just trying to create a smoke screen, not realizing that the records will bear everything out.
The question, though, is that fraud, as opposed to, I mean, because again, this is a person who's applying, they haven't been approved yet. Is that fraud if they've not received money, if they've not received benefits? I mean, I can certainly see if somebody, created this whole fake persona, they were approved, they're getting money, getting checks every month, but this is a person who's applied, they go in and they basically over-exaggerate what they're doing. Is that still fraud?
Well, Social Security defines fraud as someone who is making a statement or proceeding to engage in some activity for the purposes of getting on benefits. And then it's also similar fault, where a person maybe makes a statement, not necessarily planning on committing fraud, but maybe that statement was not entirely accurate. So what we had always trained people to understand the difference between the two of these is intent. So what is the intent of that individual? Is it to commit fraud, or maybe it is just a statement that they made that was not completely accurate? So to your question, fraud starts with intent. When a person intends to commit fraud, then we consider that fraud, regardless of whether they are on the rolls for Social Security or in the process of trying to get on the rolls. So that's really the nutshell what that looks like.
When would Social Security send out an investigator? I get this question a lot. Do they send out investigators? And if so, what's the threshold for that to happen?
The investigators will be sent out once there are certain criteria that are met in the case to inform Social Security that this could be potentially a fraud case. Now, I will say that in a lot of cases that I was involved in with CDI, the Cooperative Disability Investigations, a lot of the people were not really trying to commit fraud, but there were some that intended to. But here's the thing. Investigators are using a certain type of criteria that is in policy. Certain various thresholds. There are certain things that they look for in the records, certain things they look for in the forms or the applications, certain things they see the person presenting at the consultative exam to prompt an investigation. Now, the investigation is not saying that this person is fraudulent, but in a lot of cases, is really to kind of clear up the discrepancy. Okay, this is a situation we see here. We see this person is showing up at a consultative exam and not putting forth the best effort. Well, that may be a red flag for investigators to go out and interview this person at their home or wherever they are and ask them questions about what they said on their forms, allegations, and so on. There are times when the investigators will go out before a consultative exam, and then look at what's happening and make a judgment based on what they see in the file.
So is it fair to say that, I mean, I assume there's a certain percentage of people who may be subject to an investigation. They don't even know that. They wouldn't necessarily know that there's an investigation going on. Correct?
Some will, but most times they won't know.
Okay.
Until they get the visit.
And how, I mean, and I'll tell you, I've been doing this for 35 years. I mean, I can only think of three or four cases where I knew there was an investigation going on. How common is it for SSA to send out an investigator?
Well, I'll put it in this scope. There are over 30 CDI offices nationwide. When I worked for CDI at the time, there are roughly 15. So that gives you an idea of how serious Social Security takes fraud. They have a zero tolerance for fraud. And the increase in CDI offices is one way to see how serious they're taking it. So they want to make sure that the Social Security Trust Fund is going to be protected and protected in a very aggressive way. So when we look at this situation with people who are intending to file for disability for a fraudulent purpose, it's only a matter of time.
Okay. Let me ask you about the Eric Kahn case. And I bring that up because that is the one that obviously, you know, a lot of folks in Congress get very worked up about. I think there was maybe a TV series about it. I didn't see it, but I think there was maybe an HBO or some sort of a TV series about it. Tell my audience about Eric Kahn, what he did, and why that case was so significant in the Social Security, the history of Social Security, if you could.
Eric Kahn, so-called Mr. Social Security.
Mr. Social Security was, with the billboards.
Yeah, he was a now disbarred attorney who practiced, that's using the term loosely, disability law and assisting people to get on Social Security disability benefits. He was involved in the largest scheme in history, to where he defrauded Social Security to the tune of $550 million.
Wow.
So he was bribing an administrative law judge to take his clients and approve them for benefits. And his office, I believe somewhere around $23 million, he was able his office benefited from those cases to the tune of $23 million. So when the authorities caught up with him, they arrested him, of course, and tried him. And then he was on the ankle monitor. He cut the ankle monitor off, flew to Honduras, and tried to escape the authorities, and was on the run for 6 months until he got brought back to the U.S. and had more time tacked onto his sentence. So he was the poster child, and he was very, very living lavishly and it had a lot of the trappings that come with this type of fraud. And it all came to a halt. So I think government may see something like that, where they have seen situations like that and said, well, we need to crack down because this could be happening anytime. But again, he's more of an anomaly than anything.
Yeah, it's my sense as well that it was an unusual situation. He got, you know, obviously, I didn't realize the extent of it, but lots and lots of money. But I think what that's done is it's poisoned the well to some degree in Congress. What was the reaction in Social Security when this all came down?
You know, to be honest, when when you look at certain offices, DDSs and field offices, they likely would not even know about ERICOM.
Mm-hmm.
I would venture to say that the majority of people wouldn't even know who he was. Even in certain disability circles, he's pretty largely unknown. That's not to say that Social Security is just taking the ostrich approach and having a head in the sand. It's just saying that for something like that, as flagrant as what he did, was so so much a lightning rod in society. For the average Social Security disability worker, that did really register, not because they were oblivious. It's just that there are other types of fraud that really hit the target for them more so than an attorney. They're more focused on the claimants. They're focused on third parties. They're focused on groups, and they're also focused on those who are on the rolls already and then found out later that they did this through fraudulent means.
Got it. I mean, I think that just because I know, again, from the questions I'm getting, people are obviously very concerned. And I'll give an example of something that I see a good bit. I'll get an email from someone who says, here's what my MRI says. And they describe in very technical terms what the MRI says. And looking at it, basically the MRI says they've got, you know, degenerative disc disease. And, you know, it's very mild. There's maybe a mild disc bulge, nothing really else. But they, you know, it looks really bad, you know, spondylosis. So they see this, you know, all these $10 words. If somebody, you know, is basically maybe overstating the amount of pain they're in based on an MRI that shows kind of just a mild degenerative disc disease, that would not rise to the level of fraud, I'm thinking. Am I correct on that?
That's correct. Yeah. Absolutely correct. For an examiner to look at that case, they would basically use the issue of credibility.
Mm-hmm.
So a person might say that I have severe pain when I walk and I can't drive very far. I can only do certain household chores and duties. I have trouble taking care of my personal hygiene. And that's their report. But the findings on the MRI or a CAT scan would show, okay, well, this is on a mild level or moderate level. So we would approach that as a person being partially credible.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not fully credible because the report that they have of their symptoms doesn't match to the standard of what the records show. So it's not fully credible. And this person is not credible where, you know, well, they're just really over-exaggerating it. There's something there in the records. It's just not credible enough to be considered as a severe impairment.
Don't know where to begin? Get my free Secrets to Getting Approved Survival Kit. Inside the kit, I discuss such things as how do you know if you have a case? What to do if you're denied? How to avoid common mistakes? And my ever popular, how to avoid trick questions from the judge. Subscribing is free and easy. Just visit ssdanswers.com and look for the survival kit for instant access. Remember, time is eroding your position every day. Don't delay, act now. That's ssdanswers.com for your free survival kit. Right. And again, I mean, obviously for those listening, I mean, when I'm, you know, when the case is denied, that's usually the language that a judge would use, is that this person's not fully credible. So there is a line, you know, you can have a person who has complaints and any reasonable person would say, yeah, I can understand why you may have some level of pain, but it's just not at the level where it would disable you from all work versus a person who is, you know, basically just completely, you know, coming up with just all these symptoms that have no basis in reality at all, that may approach the level of fraud. Or a person who, like you said, goes into the consultative evaluation and just kind of creates this whole persona of a person unable to do anything at all. The other thing I see and I get questions about would be, you know, work. And I know people, you know, sometimes it's a matter of survival, but they go to work and they're paid cash. You know, that's problematic. Or, you know, if they go to work, I always tell people, you know, you can try to work. They have the, you know, unsuccessful work attempts, you know, certainly don't necessarily hurt your case, and working below SGA or substantial gainful activity level, not a problem. But I think where you get into problems is when you go to work someplace and you're getting paid under the table. That's where I think you run into problems, because a lot of that stuff, you know, it'll be in the medical record. The, you know, the doctor, you may report to your doctor that I got hurt, you know, when I fell off a ladder. Well, that suggests maybe you were doing some work. So I just to reassure people out there, you know, simply reporting something that that you're living with, you're in a lot of pain, but maybe the medical record is not completely consistent with that. That's not fraud. It's got to be sort of at a different level, right? I mean, that's what I'm picking up from what you're saying.
Yes, very, very much so. It is really about being able to be consistent with the report and making sure that the claimant's report is in step with the records. And that's when that person is going to have a lot more credibility to the examiner to see that this person actually is suffering from this and the records show this.
Speak, if you can, about the importance of objective evidence. By objective, I mean things like MRIs or CTs or ultrasounds, just objective testing. Tell the audience why that's so important from the perspective of Social Security.
In my book, The 10 Disability Commandments, I talk about commandment number 4, which is evidence is king. If you don't have evidence, you don't have much of the case. Mm-hmm. If you don't have the right kind of evidence, then you're not going to have a strong case. And objective medical evidence in the eyes of the DDS rules the world. You have to have signs and findings. Symptoms are great. Symptoms will help. Symptoms will kind of paint inside the lines, but you need the lines. And the lines are signs and findings, because that's what doctors see and tests show. So it's highly critical to a person's case to have records from an acceptable medical source. A chiropractor, unfortunately, is not an acceptable medical source. Nope. A therapist, unfortunately, if they don't have MD or PhD behind their name, is not an acceptable medical source. So there has to be evidence that shows that a doctor, an MD or PhD, saw what you have happening, saw what is going on, can continue to see what's going on, and over duration, 12 months or more, being able to see this has been a consistent thing. And if you remain the same or it's gotten worse. And then the lab findings are really the tests, the procedures, the operations, anything that doesn't have a bias in large part, an x-ray, a CAT scan, a Doppler, the psychological testing. There's some variation in some cases, but in large part, these are going to be very reliable when it comes to a person's case. So objective medical evidence is indispensable and irreplaceable.
Yeah, I know I have this conversation with clients frequently, you know, let's say with a back pain case, no MRI, it's like, you know, you're going to have a really hard time. I mean, MRI being kind of the gold standard, you know, you don't have an MRI. Nowadays, you can get an MRI for $300-$500, which it's something, but it's not $1,500 like it used to be. So that's probably money well spent. All right, tell me, we've talked a little bit about the fraud. Tell me what you're doing now. You left Social Security. You've got your own business going on. Tell me what you do. How it works, how people get a hold of you, and just kind of generally what the Disability Yoda is, if you could.
Okay, so the Disability Yoda is, Yoda is an acronym for Your On-Point Disability Advisor. So what I do, I help people who are applying for the first time or maybe for the first time in a long time. And I specifically focus on SSDI because SSI has a lot of different angles that it takes I'm sure you know, just disabled children. There's the multi-category blindness cases. There's homeless cases, and so on. So instead of trying to serve everybody, I wanted to focus on one particular audience, and that is those who have worked, who have paid into the system, so to speak. They have their quarters of coverage in place, and they are dealing with a disability and yet don't know how to navigate the process, maybe because of fear, maybe because they're afraid of making a mistake, maybe because there's a whole lot of stress that comes with that, filling out forms and applications. So what I do is help them navigate them with information, with my services, and with my YouTube channel, that just gives them a bit more comfort in knowing that they can actually do this themselves with the right type of support, with the right type of information, and also with the right type of mindset.
And is this something, and how would somebody reach out to you if they were interested? How do you charge for it? How does that all work?
Well, what I do is I have a platform where there's three levels of service that I provide. The high end would be actually working with me. And to put it in perspective, as you know, Jonathan, right now, to work with a disability attorney and to be allowed for benefits to be approved, they would pay the attorney anywhere up to $7,200 or
25%.
25% of their back pay,
Correct.
right? Either whichever is less. So my high-end service is $2,500 basically for the year, which is a fraction of what they would get or have to pay an attorney. Of course, I have monthly installments of $249, $247 rather. So they can do it on a monthly basis. But that's the high end. That's working with me. I also have two other levels where it's much more affordable. The low end is $25 a month or $250 for the entire year. So someone who is struggling, maybe not working, well, they can get some services through me just on the low end.
Got it. Got it. And just so you know, I mean, obviously a lot of people, there's different stages in a disability application. You file the initial application, which we talked about, then you have the reconsideration, then you get to a hearing. Do you do hearing work? You get to that point?
No, I don't. I leave that to the attorneys.
Okay.
Yeah, my focus is helping people understand if they want to get an attorney at the initial or recon level, feel free. I'll never stop a person from doing that. I'll never steer them away from that. My focus is to help them understand that attorneys really are driven on the ALJ level and dealing with those cases more so than the person who is applying for the first time, because they won't get the level of service that someone who is applying at the ALJ would get. So I'm trying to fill in that space to help attorneys know there's another resource here where if you are not really getting enough skin in the game to really work with individuals who need the help, but are not going to get the bedside manner that they're looking for. Well, that's where I come in for the person who is coming in fresh for the first time.
And one thing I think that we talked about this offline a little bit, but folks who have terminal illnesses would seem to be a very good fit for you because, again, those cases, honestly, from my perspective, those cases typically are going to get approved early. And again, my attitude is if I can help somebody, I will. But you're right. I mean, I can't afford to spend, a big chunk of my day working on cases where there'll be no. There's no percentage because there'll be no past due benefits. We have the 5 month waiting period, which obviously, eats into that. So tell me how you would deal with a person who's got a terminal illness and how you'd be able to assist a person like that, if you could.
Be glad to. So For a person who has a terminal illness, we call those TERI cases. I'm sure you know that. One of the three or four cases that are fast-tracked through the DDS. So for a person who has a terminal illness and is applying for a TERI case, the first thing they need to do is determine whether they're eligible. And I talk about how to do that in a very efficient way, find out if they're eligible. The second thing is to completely fill out an application, but make sure that when a person does that, they need to specify, I have a terminal illness, and to make sure that the case is flagged as a terminal illness case, as a TERI case. So how I would help them is to provide the support that says, okay, this video will show you how to apply for this case. Walk through step by step. And then make your checks every now and then with the field office to make sure that this case is being fast tracked. Because unfortunately, even sometimes with TERI cases, they may get held up in the field office.
It drives me crazy when that happens.
Yeah. And it doesn't make sense. Or the case doesn't get flagged at all. So that's why I would suggest make sure that this case is flagged. Tell the claims rep, you need to make sure this is flagged terminal illness. And then I would also help them understand, because what I do with many people on a YouTube channel and the other channels that other platforms that I have, I've offered a 30-minute case review that's complimentary. So I would walk them through the listing that applies to their impairment and show them in the listing, in the blue book, this is what your outcome is going to be. You need to apply right away, and then encourage them. And then also I would encourage them to get their family to help them, or somebody that is concerned about them that's willing to help. That's really the key element. Being able to have someone who's going to run alongside them and say, hey, you don't have to deal with the stress. I will handle the stress for you and get these applications or forms done. And then do the checks with the field office as well as the DDF to make sure that this case is expedited.
Got it. And how would someone reach you? Someone who's interested in speaking with you or communicating with you, what's the best way to do that?
I'm on Facebook. And my Facebook is the Disability Yoda, Yoda. I'm also on LinkedIn as Greg-Brinkley. And my YouTube channel is there as well, the Disability Yoda, Greg Brinkley. And they can reach me through there. I always have links in the descriptions on how they can reach me. And then also my book, The 10 Disability Commandments, is available as well at gregbrinkley.org/disability.
Okay. Very good. Well, Greg, I appreciate your time very much. Thank you. Very enlightening. Always when I do these interviews, I learn something, and I certainly did today. And so I really appreciate, again, thank you very much for coming on. We'll talk very
Thanks,
soon.
Thanks, Jonathan. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it. Anytime.
You got it.
Well, that's a wrap for today's episode. Subscribe to this podcast for regular updates at iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you found this podcast useful, then please give me a 5-star review, because it helps others see the value of my information. Thank you in advance. For a 100% free and confidential evaluation of your case, visit ssdanswers.com. That's ssdanswers.com. Don't delay. Act now.